In some ways, the United States was founded on a type of, if not outright anti-intellectualism, then a thoroughgoing pragmatism that devalued the life of the mind. This has always made the U.S. version of public education, whether at the elementary, secondary, or university levels, inhospitable to learning for its own sake. Throughout our history, not only have American intellectuals had to deal with that, but also with the demonizing and scapegoating of intellectuals when Americans perceived their interests were threatened. Recall the McCarthy period, when university professors, writers, actors, artists, poets, journalists, Jews, gays, etc., were targeted as communists and canceled, or worse. The Soviet Union, motivated by similar paranoia, suppressed the same types of people in the name of anti-capitalism. The Nazi regime terrorized and killed those labeled the enemies of the people, burning books, and locking schools and universities into a vicious ideological propaganda machine. Plato knew that all governments in which the wise did not rule would target philosophers. By their very nature, intellectuals routinely question everything. They can support stabilizing institutions, but much of the time they do not. Even when they do lend their capabilities in support of stabilization, they remain aware that what they're doing is partial, a compromise with the truth, for some supposedly greater good. But those in power know that even those good philosophers retain the potential for the subversion of the status quo. They are right to be suspicious. Intellectuals are socially dangerous, but societies stagnate without them, and especially modern societies, because they thrive on innovation and change. And we are beginning to see the type of cultural and political senility that results from a long campaign against the freedom of American thought leaders. As a professor at an American university, I've always had to justify my position by extolling the practical impact of what I teach. Will my students find jobs faster? Will those jobs pay well and have growth potential? However, jobs are not the only important reason for higher education, even if my society treats them as such. Perhaps even Eric Voegelin, if he were alive today, would recognize the current bourgeois attitude towards the ultimate questions of truth, beauty, and goodness as another instance of the foreclosure to transcendent questions he once recognized only in Soviet socialist propaganda. Quite obviously, the United States is experiencing a precipitous decline in constructive citizenship. It is still unacceptable to say that citizens who have to grapple with history, philosophy, and literature in the arts will understand better what government is for and think in terms of the longer view and the common good. I consider the long-term lack of a quality education among the chief reasons why my country, quite again, obviously, continues its slide into cultural mediocrity and its by now infamous, shallow, idiotic politics. It feels as though the university is schizophrenic because it is. Responsibility is diffused over many units, all operating as independent entrepreneurs, ever more responsible for their own funding. Certainly in these conditions, who can think about what is true? Who cares about the ultimate cause of things? Who believes that we really play a role in solving the wicked problems of our day? Do we really want to solve them at all? Or does our continued existence depend on them going unsolved? I would argue that this organizational confusion is more and more prevalent throughout our society in areas public and private. It represents the long-term unintended consequences of the Reagan-Thatcher era push towards budget cutting, devolution, and privatization in the name of efficiency and economic growth. Budgets for public universities have been cut to the bone, resulting in major reductions in programming, and in some cases, elimination of entire departments. Kansas universities are largely funded by student tuition and by the donations and grants that they can raise, not by state funding. Budget cuts and the constant pressure from our legislature and Board of Regents to become more like the iconic businesses we adore have led to this decimation. Secretaries, janitors, and tenure-track faculty seem to shrink in tandem. Neoliberal policies were sold to us as a means of efficiency and thrift, but they have led to a great enlargement of governance diffused over many agencies, often now in the private sector, which has actually become a de facto arm of the public sector. It's contracts and subcontracts all the way down. As a result, there is much less transparency and accountability to citizens. Ironically, these moves were supposed to make the liberal individual stronger, but they have actually made him almost completely powerless, lost in a maze of public and private organizational actors that are impossible to meaningfully engage. This is the malaise of neoliberal fragmentation. Its symptoms of technical rationality and diffused responsibility create a dehumanized atmosphere in which unethical outcomes simply happen. It is particularly hard on the liberal arts, which still weakly represent the search for higher motivations and values. The original goal of a university was to foster knowledge that could enlighten the world. Now the university has been remade by the world into a big box store of credentials. This is the atmosphere in which our students are educated, and it is the mirror image of the arena into which they emerge to look for work, an arena in which automation is becoming more and more dominant, leading to radical insecurity. Let me spend a little bit of time on the larger technological and economic forces putting pressure on Americans and making the question, why should I get a university education, increasingly reasonable? While automation has shrunk the need for manual and intellectual labor alike and has given many of us more flexible hours and working conditions, the negative effects on our workforce have included a decrease in full-time work and job security and an increase in monotonous, dehumanizing labor. Artificial intelligence will accelerate this phenomenon for those involved in previously solid jobs in the technical fields and in the so-called managerial elite. For many, automation is leading to an uncertain retirement. Workers in the new economy, even if they are highly educated, often do things that are not challenging and involve less real, meaningful, and interaction with other people. More and more of them are classified as contractors by vectoral companies who do not want to assume any degree of responsibility for their health or retirement. As consumers, our students go into the world conditioned to buy more than they need and to go into debt to do so. Because of this, many of them will be plagued at every stage of their life, not just by student debt, but by accumulated consumer debt, fueled by the receding dream of the ideal middle-class lifestyle. While automation has worked this transformation, the globalized economy has greatly increased the pool of labor from which corporations can draw. It has led to a rapid decline in real wages and opportunities in developed countries, especially for those without advanced technical skills, like many liberal arts graduates. The political problems that this decline has caused are now hard to ignore, certainly in the United States. Our citizens know that their country is an international economic hegemon, and so their expectations are particularly high and their disappointment more pronounced. Our students believe that they have fewer opportunities than their parents and that they will probably be less secure as they enter their retirement years. The immense student debt that many of them carry certainly doesn't help them to feel more hopeful. Briefly, how did the neoliberal gutting of our public institutions happen? Over time, federal and state level political leaders have made decisions that encourage the development of corporations over diversified local and regional businesses, especially since Citizens United versus the FEC in 2008, Supreme Court case, and partly from a fear of what would happen to them if they didn't compete with their rivals. Corporations have found ways to supply massive amounts of money to political campaigns at every level of U.S. government. It's hard to argue that these contributions haven't had an influence on legislators if we ask whether they produce a general bias in lawmakers in favor of corporate business. In other words, the effect of all that money produces a pro-corporate environment. At a bit deeper level, some critics are fond of pointing out that liberal Democrats have done very little to stop the trends that have led to economic and cultural inequality in the U.S., despite their political rhetoric. Harsher critics argue that the left has literally abandoned its fight for the poor and working class in favor of engaging in ideological battles that are easy to manipulate in our media. Conveniently, with culture war issues like abortion rights, gay and transsexual rights, and other morality issues, success is always just beyond reach. If the left has abandoned its chief goal of actually solving economic inequality, it is because Americans on all parts of the political spectrum have retreated into largely therapeutic talk about cultural inequality rather than meaningful action about either economic or cultural inequality. For average citizens, culture war arguments in our media are like the figures on the wall in Plato's cave. They are theater, but they are rarely impacted by them. While ordinary citizens might have attended a university, they are not working at one, nor are they working at a high-level corporate office. They are in jobs with less prestige, but they still want to feel a part of the national spectacle, and they take sides as though battling over issues like critical race theory and cancel culture actually affect their daily lives. The utilitarian education American universities now provide them simply helps maintain this situation. Graduates do not, on average, have the depth to realize the difference between political theory, theater, and substance. If their professors can no longer navigate or even understand their own work environment, and if their professors no longer conceive of themselves as members of a learning community in any meaningful way, how could they prepare students to deal with major political questions having to do with the meaning of life and what constitutes the common good? The complete replacement of the four-year degree with technical information and artificial intelligence seems imminent. Jacques Ellul would recognize this situation as the terminal point of the development of technique in education. In The Technological Society, Ellul wrote about the futuristic notions of scientists from the 1960s about what life would be like in 2000. Some of their predictions haven't materialized, such as the elimination of hunger by the creation of a synthetic food system. We have a synthetic food system, but we haven't eliminated hunger. However, their vision for the future manipulation of information seems more accurate. This is a quote from Ellul. Quote, the most remarkable predictions concern the transformation of educational methods and the problem of human reproduction. Knowledge will be accumulated in electronic banks and transmitted directly to the human nervous system by means of encoded electronic messages. There will no longer be any need for reading or learning, mountains of useless information. Everything will be received and registered according to the needs of the moment. There will be no need for attention or effort, end quote. Our society needs to be able to think about ultimate values now more than ever, but we're closer to that dystopian future than we ever have been. We're almost irretrievably divided and confused, and our political system is showing signs of fracturing. Americans' growing sense of insecurity amidst plenty has coincided with increased migration from Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East, much of it involving people fleeing far worse conditions in their home countries. They are willing to do jobs that Americans consider too hard or that pay too little for them to want. Immigration, legal and illegal, has led many U.S. citizens to have a misplaced anger towards migrants. At the same time as in many countries in Europe, the influx of migrants has put more pressure on our cultural and community resources, in some parts of the country much more so than in others. Americans often feel that immigrants and minorities are obtaining jobs and prestige on the basis of their racial attributes rather than on their merit. These events simply make it more likely that the frustration of those who do not feel like they are winning in life's lottery will foster resentment that will spill into ideological extremism. This dynamic has definitely contributed to the fact that beyond urban areas, most of the U.S. is red. And it accounts for why both the red and blue oscillate in an endless shouting match that seems to get more vulgar and triggering as the months and years go by. Many of us no longer identify as American citizens so much as members of one side or another in this culture war. If I disagree with my president, he is not my president. Our students are the children of red or blue parents and are either conditioned accordingly or so turned off to politics, they simply do not want to hear about social issues. The truth is, our political turmoil is a symptom of the economic system we have and the political choices we have made. But we cannot say this. If we did say it, most likely few people would hear it. And if they did, they would simply label it dangerous.